потом вот. Okay, so we saw last time that unlike what Colby accused him of, Van't Hoff did have evidence. He had these handful of molecules that were optically active, some of them in both right and left-handed forms, and they all had a special carbon in them that had four different things on it. Some of them had two, right? And Van't Hoff designed an experiment that his friend Bremer carried out. If you took one of these things that had four that was optically active and you changed one of the groups from OH to H so that it was now only three different kinds of groups, then it was no longer optically active. Even though most things you'd do would keep the thing optically active. So he really did have evidence. Okay, and in fact, he built these models of tetrahedral carbon and gave them to his friend Bremer, who had done the experiment for him. They exist in a science museum in Leiden now. And you can see that in some of the tetrahedral models, he colored the faces different colors to show four different things and how you could put them together, so that the face was what was attached to the carbon. But in others, he colored the vertices, right, and then you'd make a bond by putting two points together. Okay, what are these things over here? Those aren't tetrahedra. Can you guess what he made those for? For Bremer? Right, they're Ladenburg's benzene, so you can show that here's AB, and if you made BA, it wouldn't be superimposable. Okay? Now, so he put illustrations in this brochure that he published, especially in the German translation. He had this one, which is things that are not optically active, right? These don't rotate light, but when you have a double bond between two carbons, as you see by their sharing an edge instead of a vertex, then you can get these two things that he denotes said should be red. They could be on the same or on opposite sides. So this explains why you have two isomers of the dicarboxylic acid that has a double bond in the middle. Okay, so it explained that. In order not to get so many isomers as Paterno wanted to have, where you could get different isomers for different phases of rotation, he had this figure showing that the rotation was free. And I won't read all that, but the important thing is that you could have, because this rotation is free, or at least rapid, you have rapid interconversion among these so-called isomers, and therefore you can't isolate them or handle them separately, so they're treated as one. Sharif?
Can you please show the double bond again?
Why don't you go back to look at it, because it'll mess up the timing on the thing.
Okay.
But I'll bring a model in next time to show you. Okay, actually you can see the same kind of thing here. The double bond is the first two is a double bond, right? It shares two vertices. The substituents are at the corner. The carbon itself is in the middle. And it shares with the next carbon two vertices, so it's a double bond. But he noticed that if you put two double bonds in a row made out of tetrahedra like this, the top one and the bottom one are oriented the same way, but the top one has substituents on the top and the bottom ones have ones in the bottom, so they're in different planes, right? So that means that if you tried to superimpose these two, they would superimpose at the top, but at the bottom, blue would go on red and red on blue, and obviously if you turned it around, it would mess it up at the top. So there should be two isomers that are mirror images of one another of a disubstituted alene. So he made this prediction in this book in 1874, and it wasn't shown experimentally that you could have optical activity in alenes until this paper by your great-great-grandfather in 1935, right? So this was 61 years after theory had predicted it that it was finally shown to be true, so that must be some kind of record for verification of a theory. So you can see the picture down in the lower left there of the molecule that Kohler made together with his co-workers. And you see that if you have it like that, and if the carbon in the middle makes tetrahedral bonds, then you have a problem. Where is the problem? Can you see? So this carbon is also tetrahedral, right? This one's tetrahedral. Bonds go in and out, up and down. Here they go up and down, in and out. But here you got a problem, because all the bonds start out in the same plane. So that one's not a tetrahedral carbon. So in fact, if you had it like that, that would be a single bond only, because the p orbitals, as we would talk about them nowadays, wouldn't overlap with one another, so you don't have a double bond. In order to get the double bond, you have to twist the far right by 90 degrees so that you can get overlap. So you could get this isomer with the C10H7 in front. And if you wanted to get the isomer in, from this to the isomer in, with the C10H7 in back, you'd have to rotate. And in the process of rotating, you'd break the pi bond, as we just showed. Right, so there you'd break it, it's only a single bond, and now you can restore it with the C10H7 in back. But there's going to be a big barrier losing that second bond, so it's going to be hard to do that. Okay, now you have already had some exercise in doing these things in 3D. I'm going to go through just a couple of them rapidly here. Yeah, Aviva? You don't. Okay, we'll get to that later about how you know. All these things, there's a right and a left-handed one. But if you had two bottles, how do you know which one's which? Right, that's a big problem. And that was a problem that wasn't solved for 75 years, as you'll see. Okay, so we were counting isomers of these things if they were in three-dimensional space. For example, you could have a mono with the hydrogen at the top substituted, or one at the bottom substituted. But those ones at the bottom, there's another one at the top, but of course that's the same as the first one at the top. You could just rotate it like that, and the blue would go into the red. Everything else would superimpose, right? But how about that blue one at the bottom? Would that be the same as the red one at the bottom or not? Right? Because the same rotation would superimpose them. But the one in front at the bottom is not superimposable by rotation. So does that count or not? How real are the models is the question. So we don't know for sure about that. So there are at least two isomers, top and bottom, and there might be another one on the bottom if the models really mean something geometrically rather than just being some kind of graph. Okay, so if mirror images count as different, then there's an extra one. There are three of those. The same thing is true over here because it's the same pattern, two on the top and four symmetrically related on the bottom, so that would be the same story. That would have three for mono-substituted isomers, top, middle, and bottom, but then they could be on the right or on the left, and those aren't superimposable, so you get another three, so there could be six of those, and so on. I'm not going to go through all these. But then if you start getting two, and when you get over to Ladenburg benzene, there's only one. They're all superimposable by rotations. Okay, if you start di, then you could put the first one on the top, and if you put the first one on the top, then there are three different places you could put the second one, or maybe five if you count ones that are mirror images, and so on and so on. So a total of six and maybe nine, and the same for the third one there because it has the same pattern. And then so on. You can do these, and you've done these, but I just thought it would be handy for you to have the answers to check, and if maybe you'll find I made a mistake. Let me know if I did. Okay, now, mirror images. That's an interesting thing. An interesting thing is when you look in a mirror, that top and bottom are right, but right and left are exchanged, right? Doesn't that seem funny to you? Why don't you appear standing on your head in a mirror? If it changes right and left, why doesn't it change top and bottom? Do you ever worry about that? The answer to that, does anybody know the answer to that puzzle? Yeah, Aviva?
The way the mirror kind of acts as a lens, and the way the light goes through.
It bends the light or something like that? No, that's not it. That happens if you look at a spoon. If you look at yourself in a spoon, then you see yourself not right and left, but upside down. Right? And if you use a cylinder, then it's the true image, except you maybe look fat or thin or something like that. Yeah?
Well, a plane mirror isn't a lens, but it's just how it works, how it reflects.
It's just how it works?
It's how it follows the law of reflection, right? So.
But still, why does it not change top and bottom if it changes right and left?
Finger here goes reflects here, but your
leg. Yeah?
Because
what?
Left and right are relative to each different person.
But why is left and right, why is top and bottom not relative? You could stand on your head too, right?
I guess we can't stand on the ceiling.
You're getting close. Okay, here's the answer. That clearly it changes neither. Right? Top is top and right is right. Right? What it changes is front and back. Right? When I look into the mirror, I don't see the back of my head, which is what I'm really like. I see my face. It changes in and out. It doesn't change right and left. Right? But our intuition is not accustomed to the idea of doing that. It's if I see somebody and they're looking at my face, I think they've turned around. Right? Which that's what changed right and left is inside my brain, thinking that in order to have their face to me, they must have turned around, that they couldn't have gone and sucked in and gone inside out, right? Front to back. Right? So really it doesn't change right and left. It's just we think that it changes right and left, because if we see somebody from their face, we think that what's on the right is their left hand. Okay. Okay, so Lewis Carroll was interested in this, and Alice went through the looking glass, as you know. Now, let's think about Alice going through the looking glass as the title. So there she's leaning on the mirror with her right hand sticking up. Okay, now let's look at the next picture. If we rotated this, that would be her right hand still. Okay? Everybody with me? Still her right hand. Okay? That's her right arm. If we rotate it back again, that's her right arm. Okay? Now, Carroll was nobody's fool. He was a mathematician, as you know, at Oxford. But the guy who drew the picture, John Tenniel, turned out to have only one eye. So maybe he wasn't so good at three dimensions. Maybe is that the problem here? Okay? Because it's called through the looking glass. Because if she actually could go through the looking glass, her right arm would still be her right arm. That's what we showed. But if she looked at her image in the looking glass rather than through the looking glass, then what she sees on the other side would be her left arm. Right? What she sees in the thing. So it's just, I think that's sort of interesting and subtle that it's through the looking glass that she actually went through rather than her mirror image operating in the other territory. Okay? Now, this was 1872. And Carroll was at Oxford and he was in Christ Church College, where Vernon Harker was also, who was a chemist. And he was closely in contact with Wislicenus, the guy who was working on lactic acid. And finding out, showing that the two things had the same constitution, the right and the left-handed acid. This was before Van 't Hoff, right? 2 years before Van 't Hoff did his thing. But already, Wislicenus knew that these things were in some sense right-handed and left-handed. Right? So it's interesting what you see in this book. Now, if you'll only attend, Kitty, and not talk too much, I'll tell you about all my ideas about Looking Glass House. Well then, the books are something like our books, only the words go the wrong way. I know that because I've held up one of our books to the glass, and then they hold up one in the other room. How would you like to live in Looking Glass House, Kitty? I wonder if they'd give you milk there. Perhaps Looking Glass milk isn't good to drink. Right? Because the milk acids are the right and left-handed. Right? That's almost certainly true, I think, that that's the source of that. Whether it was the wrong acid, the sarcolactic acid, rather than Shayla's lactic acid that you'd see in Looking Glass House. Okay, so chirality. The Greek hair means hand. And it also appears in the word surgeon. Do you know what surgeon means? A surgeon is someone who uses his hands or her hands to fix you by cutting you and whatnot, as opposed to a physician who gives you medicine. Right? So that comes from hand. So care is hand. And in 1893, Lord Kelvin said, I call any geometrical figure or group of points chiral and say it has chirality if its image in a plane mirror, ideally realized, cannot be brought to coincide with itself. Okay, so there's the right hand, and here's a coordinate system. Now, suppose I were to change... So every point on the hand has an XYZ coordinate. Suppose I take all those coordinates, but I change the sign of X. So wherever X is positive, I make it negative. Can you see what that would do? Change the sign of all X coordinates. What would the hand look like? Yeah. Yeah, the things that have high X would be at low X, but the Y and the Z would be the same. Okay, it would look like that. Now, it says, remember he said ideally realized. These are my hands. I mean, I might have a wart or something on one hand that wouldn't be on the other, right? But still, ideally, they're mirror images of one another. So those are related by a mirror that's in the YZ plane, right here. Relates right hand to left hand. Now, suppose instead of changing the sign of X, suppose I changed all the Y coordinates of the right hand. Then what would I get if I exchanged the sign of the Y coordinates? What hand would I get? Would I get a right hand or a left hand, and where would it be? Richard? And where would it be? Back and where? There are eight quadrants. I'm changing the sign of Y. So everything that's down goes up. Yeah, it's be in the top right, the back, right? There. Now, what symmetry operation was that? The first one was this mirror, right? The YZ plane. What's this one? This is the XZ plane. Right, that changes the right hand to that. Okay, so that's an XZ mirror. Now, suppose I change the sign of Z. Can you tell me quickly what it would do? Just by analogy with the others, you can do it now. What will it do? It'll do the XY mirror, right? So it'll be over there. This is the mirror. Right, so whenever I change a sign, it's like the mirror that contains the other two axes. Okay, so it always converts a right hand to a left hand, right? It's the same left hand. It's just differently positioned and oriented. But you only have one mirror image of your right hand, but it can be put in different places depending on where the mirror is. Okay, now suppose, that was the XY mirror as we said. Now suppose we change both X and Y but keep Z the same. What will happen to the right hand back in the back bottom when you do that? I'm going to keep Z the same, but I'm going to change X and Y. Do I go to right or left hand? It's still a right hand. And what operation did that? It's a rotation about what? About the axis Z, right? So it goes that one back in the top. Okay, now suppose that's a rotation about the Z axis. Suppose I change X and Z. Can you tell me what that's going to do? Sagar? Rotate around Y, the vertical axis, and it'll come out in front. And to finish up, if you that's rotation around the Y axis, and if I change Y and Z, is it going to make a right or a left hand? Is it going to stay the same or going to change? If I change two coordinates. Stay the same, and it'll be rotation about X. Okay? Now there's one missing. one octant is not there. Can you see how to get to that one? What haven't we done yet? We haven't changed all three, right? If we, that's rotation around X. If we change X and Y and Z, that's this one. It changes everything, right? It goes through a center of symmetry. So there, and it gives the one up at the top here, on the top left. So it's inversion, as it's called, through the center of the origin, right? Through there. So everything that was back and down is out in front now, and so on. Okay? So, and is it a right hand or a left hand? It's a left hand now. So notice what happens. If you change an odd number of signs, you change the hand. If you change an even number, obviously you come back again. Okay, so there's only one mirror image, but where it is depends on what kind of mirror you use. The same way that there's, you can rotate it and keep the same hand, but where that hand will be depends on what rotation axis you choose. Okay, now, chirality is non-superimposable mirror images, like your hand is non-superimposable. The right hand, as we've said, has only one mirror image, but different mirrors or the inversion center generated in different orientations. Now, so there's some molecules that are, like your hand, are chiral, right? But, Van't Hoff had a list of what, maybe 10 such molecules. Okay, so the question arises, how special is chirality? Would there be others besides the 10 he showed, or would most molecules be chiral, or would most molecules be not chiral? So, in the spirit of the season, we can decide this democratically. Okay, so we'll vote. How many people think most molecules are chiral, like the ones that Van't Hoff used? Hold your hands up. We're voting. You won't get one of these stickers if you don't vote. Okay, we got about 7 or 8. And how many people think the opposite? How many think very relatively few molecules are chiral? Okay. Special wins, right? We got more votes for it, chirality being pretty special. So the democratic answer is that it's pretty special, right? And I knew that was going to be the answer, so I could give it to you ahead of time, okay? The voice of the people is the voice of God. Okay, so let's consider words. That's what Cooper did, right, in talking about things. So let's think about words, of course, are only in two dimensions, so we don't have the Z coordinate. We only have X and Y. But still, we can do rotations and we can do reflections. Okay, so let's take a set of words here. Let's decode at noon, but keep it mum, right? This is spy stuff. Okay, now, suppose we mirror by changing the sign of X. Okay? So, what that will do is this. Now, what do you notice about the mirror words, Henry? Mum is a mirror image of itself, right? So, is it chiral or not? Chiral means you're not superimposable on your mirror image. So, mum is not chiral. But all the others are chiral. They're not superimposable on their mirror image. Okay, so that's pretty special. So mum is its own mirror image and is achiral. And sometimes we call it meso for reasons that we'll mention shortly. Now, noon is sort of suspect, even though it's not superimposable on its mirror image. Can you see? So it's chiral. Noon is chiral in two dimensions. But do you see what's special about noon? Suppose what we did was change the sign of X and Y. That's a rotation now when you change two of them. Right? Now noon looks the same. So it has rotational symmetry, but it's still chiral. Can you think of other things that have rotational symmetry, but can be right or left-handed? A propeller is of that sort. Right. Many years ago, I told a story in class, and my brother, who's a physician, was interviewing someone to join his practice, turned out that this guy had taken this class. So he asked my brother if he knew this. Oh, no, it wasn't that. He was at a table of a medical meeting, and the other guy told this story that my brother knew because it's a story from our family, because I told it in class, so I'll tell it to you now. Charlie Best. Charlie Best was this old guy. I mean, he's probably about as old as I am, but he seemed very old to me when I was in junior high. And he could make anything, and he lived in the place where we had a summer cabin, so we would go to his workshop to make things for the house. And he told the story about when he had gone to a county fair in Ohio, and he had seen some guy was selling propellers, that he had a twisted rod, and he could go like this, and the propeller would fly off. You've seen those things? That as you push it up the twisted rod, it spins, and then it flies way far away. And so Charlie thought he could do better than that. So he went to his shop, and he made a big one out of metal like this. And he got a piece of square stock, you know, long stock, and twisted it on his lathe. And he went out in the backyard and went, boom, like this. And can you see what was wrong? Who said, uh-oh? Max, did you say, oh? No. He had it twisted the wrong way, so it went out about 1 foot and then came back, and he still had a scar on his face. That's Charlie Best. It didn't permanently damage him. He didn't mind the scar. But it's a good story about chirality, right? It can make a difference. Okay. So, noon has rotational symmetry, like a propeller, but it's chiral. Okay, now, suppose we mirror by changing the sign of Y. Now what do you notice? What? Decode is right. Right? So it has a mirror too. Now, I bet you easily recognize that mum has a mirror, but you didn't easily recognize that decode has a mirror. Why? Because you're accustomed to seeing vertical mirrors, but you're not accustomed to seeing horizontal mirrors. Isn't that interesting? So anyhow, so decode is also achiral. It's a meso word, but it's harder to recognize. Okay, so how special is chirality on the basis of studying words? What do you think? Is it pretty special or not special? How hard do you think I had to work to make up that sentence? Pretty hard to get two meso words in it, right? So chirality is not special at all. Almost all molecules are chiral, right? But achiral molecules, like meso words, are very rare. Right? But when we deal with very, very simple molecules, as we do, of course, in a beginning course, or as people dealt with in terms of understanding when they were developing chemistry, then there were many of them were symmetrical. Yeah, meso. Oh, no, you don't have to, because it's like the hands. Remember, there's only one mirror image. Right? So one half of the molecule is the mirror image of the other. Right? And if you took a wrong mirror, you'd get the mirror image, but it would be moved over here or over here, the same way as depending on which mirror you use where the left hand comes out. Right? So you can recognize where the mirror is, that it's vertical in MUM and horizontal in decode. That's how you recognize it, but the mirror image is the mirror image, however you slice it. Okay, so now we're going beyond constitutional isomerism into the realm of stereochemistry, the arrangement of atoms in space. So at first, with respect to the constitution, we had composition and then constitution, and now we're going to need more categories for talking about things that are related in space. And those will be two more C's, that's how you can remember it, four C's, configuration and conformation. And those last three, constitution, configuration, and conformation, allow isomers. You have the same composition, the same pieces, but arranged differently. So they can be arranged differently according to what's bonded to what and how, or they can be bonded the same way, but arranged differently in space, and that's configuration and conformation. Now, those last two, then, are called stereoisomers, because it has to do with arrangement in space. And the distinction between configuration and conformation can be a little bit subtle, right? Because it actually is based on our bonding model. Which ones we call configuration and which ones we call conformation depends on how we talk about bonding. Because configurational isomers differ, you can get from one to the other, only by breaking a bond and reforming it in our model, right? Whereas conformations, you can get from the one to the other by rotating about single bonds. And remember, that's what Van't Hoff said, it would be fast. But it's not always fast. So it is possible to talk about isomers that are conformational isomers. But again, this is not something that the distinction between configuration and conformation can be defined that way. But Schrödinger never heard of that, and molecules never heard of that. Okay, that's in our model that we talk about the distinction between them. The fundamental difference is between things that are mirror images and things that are different but are not mirror images, however you do it. But generally, configurational isomers are hard to get back and forth between because you have to break bonds, and the others are easy, but that's not always true. There are special cases where one is hard and the other is easy. So all isomers, remember, represent local energy minima. Obviously, you could have atoms any place you want, but most of them would not be at a minimum of energy, and if you let them go, they would slide downhill. But if you have a valley and the molecules are arranged in that energy valley, they'll sit there, and there could be several valleys for different isomers. So they're not just different phases of vibration. They're different energy minima. Now, there are relationships that are stereochemical. So two molecules that have the same constitution can have different relationships, right? They can be identical. That is, they can be superimposed. They're the same thing. If you needed a name for that, which you don't, so nobody else will use this name, but we could call them homomers. They're the same, exactly the same, okay? But no one talks about them. Now, suppose they're just completely different. Right? And they'll have different properties and so on, completely different. Those are called diastereomers. And the dia means a cross. Can you think of another word that starts with dia that means a cross? Diameter measures across a circle, right? So and exactly why that should be is anyhow. But anyhow, they're across from one another, and stereo means arrangement in space. So they have the same constitution. Right, the same bonds, but they're arranged just differently in space. But then there's a very special arrangement, and what will that be? Where they're not superimposable, but they're not totally different. They could be mirror images. Right, so then they'll have a lot of properties in common if they're mirror images. All the metrics will be the same. All the distances will be the same. So if they're mirror images of one another, they're called enantiomers, and that comes from enantios, which means opposite. So the opposite in the sense here of a mirror. Okay, so you have homomers, which you never talk about, diastereomers, just plain different arrangement in spaces, completely different properties, and enantiomers. And what property will be different between enantiomers? How about boiling point? Same. How about refractive index, melting point, molecular weight? All the same. What's different? The rotation of polarized light. The crystal structures will be mirror images, but that means that the angles that faces make between them will all be the same, except in the sense that Pasteur noticed, that there'll be right-handed ones and left-handed ones. But not always will you see the faces that allow you to tell that. That was what was special about Pasteur. He did the sodium ammonium salt, which happens to show faces that do that, because many faces don't do that. Okay, so notice this is a relationship between two molecules. Two molecules can be mirror images of one another. They can be completely different. They can be the same. So it's a relationship that's being talked about here. So we have stereochemical facts that we've been talking about and ideas, the arrangement in space and Van't Hoff's ideas, and then we need words to describe it. So we just had these words, diastereo and enantio. But you need pictures, too, to be able to show complicated things. You can't just do it with words. So we want 3D in pictures that we're going to show in 2D. Right, so you could draw them by hand, or things got a lot easier when you could use computers to draw them and you didn't have to be such a good artist. So this was drawn by an early generation computer. It doesn't look nearly as fancy as what you can draw now. Okay, but there are clues here in the way it's drawn to its being three-dimensional. So what clues do you see? Size. The hydrogens, the turquoise hydrogens that are closer to you are bigger than the ones that are further away. Okay, anything else? Yeah, the ones in front overlap the ones in back and obscure them. Okay, and look at the bonds. Like, this bond is in the plane of the screen, but this bond isn't, and especially this bond isn't, or this bond isn't, or this bond. Right, they're tapered. Perspective is being used to show this. Okay? So we can have size, perspective, obstruction of things in the back by things in the front. Those are good clues to the third dimension. There's another one you can do, which is to have these two pictures. Have you ever looked like things like that? What do they call it? Magic eye or something like that? You ever do that? Where you look at one picture with one eye and one with the other. You can use mirrors to do it. But notice that these pictures aren't quite the same. Look, this hydrogen is closer to that carbon than it is to that carbon. And if you can do it and make your eyes go like that when you think you're looking straight ahead, then you see this bing in three dimensions. And I can bring in periscopes that allow you to do that. Maybe I'll do that. Or colored glasses, red, blue. Did you have a children's book that had red and blue glasses you put on and things are in three dimension? It's the same idea, to see one thing and another. It's very difficult with them that far apart unless you have some help for your eyes. Okay, so stereo pairs are a way of doing it. But there are other ways that don't require stereo pairs. Like that. Can you get a good sense of that in three dimensions? What's in front of what? I see frowns. But watch this. Look at it. Let's rotate it. Now you can see it in three dimensions, right? Because in time, your brain is doing what the two eyes did in the previous one. One sees it from one angle, one sees it for another, right? But even with one eye, you can see three dimensions here by having it rotate. Okay, or how about that? Can you see that in three dimensions? Not very well. But if we do some highlighting and shading, it comes better. And if we put balls, so we got better substrate for highlighting and shading. Or this one, that's really good in three-dimensional, right? So computers have made a big difference in being able to explain to people what you mean in three dimensions. But that's not always at hand. And sometimes you have to draw things like this. So you have to master the notation you can use for writing on an exam or casually talking to somebody about a tetrahedral carbon. So there's a tetrahedral carbon, and all the angles are 109 and a half degrees, right, in and out for dash and wedge. So that looks great. Now, I guarantee you that on some exam someone will draw that. It always has happened before. I don't see why it shouldn't happen again. Is that tetrahedral? What is the shape of those four bonds? Pardon me? Right, the one on the right is going out, the one on the left is going back, up and down. What is that? It's a cross, it's a plane. That's not a tetrahedron. Okay, so forget that one. It's planar. Now, how about that one? That one's not planar. Look good? What's wrong with it? People don't usually draw this, but I just did it for fun. Right? It's not that, because there you have 90-degree angles with the ones that are going in and out. and 180 degrees from the up and down one, not 109 degrees. It's not tetrahedral. How about that one? That looks pretty good. Do you see anything bad about it? Richard? No, the two straight ones here are the same as the two straight ones here, the angle between them. They're fine, 109 degrees. Henry?
The one that sticks out.
The one that sticks out here?
Yeah.
What about it? Look at that angle. This one's in the plane, and this one's... If this one were sticking straight toward you, it would be 90 degrees from this one, right? But it's much closer. It's a very acute angle. It's much less than 90 degrees. So that one certainly isn't a tetrahedron. Okay, so you need to practice a little bit with these things so that you can draw them right. How about that one? You see that pretty often. Look good? No, it actually, if these are all in the plane of the board, right, and that's coming out and that's going back, you have the same problem here. But actually, this one's okay. And the reason it's okay is that people get tired of drawing all these things, and they wanted to show that relatively this one is coming up relative to its neighbors, and that one's going back compared to its neighbors, and they're not trying to show that it's really tetrahedral. So people, you know, professional chemists draw things like that, but they're not trying to show that it's tetrahedral. They're just trying to show whether it's right or left-handed at a place. Okay, so that one turns out to be okay, and of course it takes a little time to learn what the conventions are. So which, when you're trying to say something to a certain person, you draw it this way. When you're trying to emphasize something else, you draw it the other way. But best at the beginning is to draw things correctly. Okay, now, models also, and the Fisher projection, which was invented in 1891 and is closely related to models. So those things at the bottom, this is taken out of Fisher's 1891 paper. And he says, with the help of Friedlander's convenient rubber models, one can construct models of right-handed tartaric acid, left-handed tartaric acid, and inactive tartaric acid, and lay them in a plane of the paper. So the four carbon atoms are in a straight line. So here's the dicarboxylic acid, right, with CHOH. There it is, right? It looks like the one in the middle. Okay? But he says if they're connected with rubber, then you can do this and make them all lie on a line, all the carbons lie on the same line. No, they're not on the same line here, right? It makes a C. Okay? But now they're all on a line if it's made of rubber. But notice, when you do that, the hydrogens, the OH and the H, right, project toward you. Right? So we could draw wedges for those if we wanted to, just to be clearer. Right? But the other bonds, the ones that are drawn by dots here, they're really funny. Right? If you rotated by 90 degrees, you'd see it looks like that. Right, so these bonds, the bond from this carbon and the bond from this carbon are both going back into the paper. That's unrealistic. At least we think it's unrealistic. Right, and in truth, X-ray will show that it is unrealistic. But because he had these rubber models, he could do it this way, and then he had a way of drawing it unambiguously and simply. Right, with the understanding that horizontal bonds come out toward you and vertical bonds go back into the plane, right, from both carbons, so they're bent. Right, it didn't mean he thought the bonds were bent, but this was a way to draw. Okay, so it depended on having rubber models. And now they're not drawn with dots, they're drawn with lines, a so-called Fisher projection. Now, why did he do Fisher projections? Well, the interesting thing about it is that if you take this Fisher projection like this, notice that if you rotate it 180 degrees around this axis, right, that's just fine. It's still unambiguous how you would draw it. Right? But if you rotate it 180 degrees around the vertical axis, then it's wrong. Why? Because the convention is that the horizontal ones come out toward you, and now they're coming back. Everybody see that? So in a Fisher projection, they have to come out, but you can do that, and they're still coming out. So you can rotate 180 degrees about an axis perpendicular to the paper, right? So you can rotate that one, right? And the letters are, of course, backwards and upside down, but it's the same picture, right? And the same here, you rotate it 180 degrees just fine, same thing. And you rotate this 180 degrees, and that's fine, although it doesn't look the same anymore, except that if we push it up beside that one, and it would be the mirror image. Does everybody see that? That the right to left mirror, these two things. Okay, so there's, or we could put the mirror someplace else and see that it's the same as its mirror image. And the neatest place to put the mirror is in the middle of the molecule, because then the top is the right, is the mirror image of the bottom. And the, and so it, so it's obviously superimposable on its mirror image because it's the same thing. Right? So in a meso compound, you can usually draw it so that there's a mirror within the molecule. Now, that was, Pasteur called that inactive. It didn't rotate light. But another Frenchman called it meso, in between. And I'm trying to find out if he said why he called it meso. One possibility is because it's between plus and minus. It's zero in its rotation. But I'm not positive. I'll hope to find that out later today. But at any rate, the name that applied to tartaric acid, mesotartaric acid, the inactive one, that meso name stuck and was generalized. So now all molecules that have a plane within them that makes them symmetrical are called meso, like MUM and DECODE are called meso because of mesotartaric acid. Okay, now again we have relationships. What's the relationship between those two? Are they identical? Are they just plain different? Or are they mirror images? The first two. You see, we can draw a mirror down there and it reflects one into the other. Okay? So those are mirror images, and what do we call them? Enantiomers. Okay? Now, how about the second and the third? Are they identical? Are they mirror images? Are they just plain different? Yeah, they're diastereomers. How about the first and the third? Those are diastereomers too. Okay, so those are important words to know. Now, why did he invent this notation? He did it in order to count isomers. If you have if you have just one stereogenic center, one carbon with four different things, you've got two isomers, right and left. Okay? Suppose you have two. Now, either of them can be right or left, so it should be 2 squared. Okay? Or if you had 3, it would be 2 to the third, or 2 to the fourth, or 2 to the fifth, right? So, is that true? No, it's not true, because of meso compounds. And this turned out to be very complicated, because Van't Hoff in 1877 said he'd consider these things that had 3 carbons in a row, both of the ones on the end have 4 different things on them. Okay, so how many isomers? He said, as is easily conceived, they lead to 3 isomers. Now, Beyer and Fischer were at a resort on the Italian Riviera at breakfast, and they were talking about this. And they used rolls, you know, bread rolls and toothpicks to try to make models of these things, and they couldn't make it work to agree with Van't Hoff. So that was the reason that Fischer figured out this way of doing it, of drawing it, so he could count properly. So they gave up on using bread rolls. So let's think about trihydroxyglutaric acid, but I guess we'll think about it next time. Okay. So if you weren't here at the beginning, we've decided I'm going to have a review session Sunday evening at 8:30.